Part 7. Apocalypse Then, The Mystery of the Cataclysm. Chapter 25. Eloise. It's early October 2017, a roasting hot mid-morning, and we've just left Tucson, Arizona, for the 80-mile drive to Murray Springs, a very rich and complex Clovis site, about 14 miles southwest of the town of Tombstone, and 20 miles north of the Mexican border. Our route takes us via I-10 and AZ-90 through increasingly sere scrub and semi-desert under a merciless sky. But when we arrive at Murray Springs itself, park, say hello to the rangers at the gate, and walk the couple of miles of the trail around the archaeological site, we find ourselves in a sort of oasis with abundant mesquite growing tall enough along the edges of the sinuous arroyo, a flood channel, to offer some welcome shade. Although flash floods still rip through here from time to time, it's rumored that the present lush environment owes more to treated sewage being dumped in the area. Santa and I are accompanied by geophysicist Alan West and his wife Nancy. Working with Jim Kennett, an earth science and oceanographer at the University of California, and Richard Firestone, a nuclear analytical chemist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, West is one of the principal investigators in a loose alliance of more than 60 scientists from many different fields who have joined forces since 2007 to try to solve a profound mystery. It concerns the Younger Dryas, the interlude of cataclysmic global climate change coinciding with the late Pleistocene extinction event, in which 35 genera of North American megafauna, with each genus consisting of several species, were wiped out around 12,800 years ago. Sharing their fate were the Clovis people and their distinctive culture with its characteristic fluted point weaponry. We climb down to the floor of the arroyo, which is about 2 meters deep and 12 meters wide at this point, and begin to walk along it. After a few moments, Alan stops. "It's around here they excavated Eloise," he says. He's referring to one of the mammoths ambushed and butchered at Murray Springs by the Clovis people some 12,800 years ago. He describes how Eloise's skeleton was found intact, except for the hind legs, which had been chopped off right after she was killed. One was moved up and placed alongside her head. Archaeologists found the other a few hundred meters away, close to the residue of an ancient campfire. Part of a broken Clovis point was also found by the campfire, while the rest of it was in Eloise. The archaeologist who excavated the mammoth in the 1960s, and who would bring Alan West and Richard Firestone to the site many years later, was Vance Haynes, Regents Professor Emeritus at the University of Arizona and a senior member of the National Academy of Sciences. The listener will recall that his adamant defense of Clovis first was a significant factor in extending the life of that now thoroughly discredited theory and in inhibiting other research indicating a much earlier peopling of the Americas. As the discoverer and principal excavator of Murray Springs, however, Haynes deserves credit for drawing attention to a very curious aspect of the site, a distinct dark layer of soil draped like shrink wrap, as Alan West puts it, over the top of the Clovis remains and of the extinct megafauna, including Eloise. Haynes has identified this black mat, his term, not only at Murray Springs, but at dozens of other sites across North America, and was the first to acknowledge its clear and obvious association with the late Pleistocene extinction event. He speaks of the remarkable circumstances surrounding the event, the abrupt die-off on a continental scale of all large mammals immediately before deposition of the black mat, and the total absence thereafter of mammoth, mastodon, horse, camel, direwolf, American lion, tapir, and other megafauna, as well as Clovis people. Haynes notes also that the basal black mat contact marks a major climate change from the warm, dry climate of the terminal Alarot to the glacially cold Younger Dryas. From roughly 18,000 years ago, and for several thousand years thereafter, global temperatures had been slowly but steadily rising, and the ice sheets melting. Our ancestors would have had reason to hope that Earth's long winter was at last coming to an end, and that a new era of congenial climate beckoned. This process of warming became particularly pronounced after about 14,500 years ago. Then suddenly, around 12,800 years ago, the direction of climate change reversed, and the world turned dramatically, instantly cold as it had been at the peak of the Ice Age many thousands of years earlier. This deep freeze, the mysterious epoch now known as the Younger Dryas, lasted for approximately 1,200 years until 11,600 years ago, at which point the climate flipped again. Global temperatures shot up rapidly, the remnant ice sheets melted and collapsed into the oceans, and the world became as warm as it is today. In addition to Murray Springs, Vance Haines reports finding at least 40 other localities in the United States with Younger Dryas Age black mat deposits. This layer, or mat, covers the Clovis Age landscape or surface on which the last remnants of the terminal Pleistocene megafauna are recorded. Stratigraphically and chronologically, the extinction appears to have been catastrophic, seemingly too sudden and extensive for either human predation or climate change to have been the primary cause. This sudden termination appears to have coincided with the sudden climatic switch from Alerod warming to Younger Dryas cooling. Recent evidence for extraterrestrial impact, although not yet compelling, needs further testing because a remarkable perturbation occurred that needs to be explained. Haines published these thoughts in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in May 2008. The extraterrestrial impact that he mentions, and finds not yet compelling, has nothing to do with aliens, but refers to a serious scientific theory, the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, that had received its first formal airing, also in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, in October 2007. The paper was co-authored by Alan West, Richard Firestone, James Kennett, and more than 20 other scientists, and presents evidence that multiple fragments of a giant comet, a swarm of fragments, struck the Earth with disastrous consequences around 12,800 years ago. The effects were global, but the epicenter of the cataclysm was over the North American ice cap, which the impacts destabilized, triggering the Younger Dryas deep freeze and the megafaunal extinctions. Haines was right to say in 2008 that this radical hypothesis needed further testing. It would receive it in the years ahead and become the focus of a furious debate that has divided scientists and continues to this day. On one side, many highly qualified and experienced specialists from many different fields are convinced that a comet swarm was indeed encountered around 12,800 years ago, and that the result was a global catastrophe, with its most extreme effects felt in North America. On the other side is a smaller but more vocal and highly influential group of skeptics who reject the theory. I reported the debate between the two factions in some detail in my book Magicians of the Gods, so won't repeat myself here. As I write these words in 2018, and despite a decade of unrelenting criticism and focused attempts at refutation, the upshot is that the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, YDIH, has stood the test of time, gained increasingly wide acceptance among scientists, and remains by far the best single coherent explanation for the cataclysmic events and extinctions, the remarkable perturbation that did indeed occur around 12,800 years ago. Alan West is at the cutting edge of the research into this colossal mystery and the co-author of more than 40 scientific papers looking into it in depth. I'm privileged to have him join me at Murray Springs. Black mat. Alan leads us over to the side wall of the arroyo, explaining as we walk that the area would have had a very different appearance 12,800 years ago. In particular, it would have been much wetter, with a string of lakes serving as watering holes for the megafauna that the Clovis hunters came here to kill. The arroyo itself is a relatively recent feature, but a useful one, because it slices vertically through a couple of meters of sediment laid down before and after the onset of the Younger Dryas, and thus functions something like an archaeological trench, revealing the layers and what's in them, stacked one on top of the other. A distinct black stratum, running horizontally like a layer in a cake, is visible on both walls of the arroyo, about a meter below present ground level. It obviously lies across the whole landscape and has been exposed here by the flash floods that cut the arroyo, as though, to extend the analogy, a slice of the cake has been removed, allowing us a glimpse of its interior. The stratum is about a hand's breadth thick. That's the black mat, Alan confirms. It doesn't look like a cataclysm, but appearances can be deceptive. The first and most obvious sign of an impact by an asteroid or comet is a crater, or multiple craters in the case of a swarm. However, the Earth's surface is dynamic, and craters can be obliterated by erosion or other geological processes, or covered over by later sediments, or submerged by rising sea levels. In the case of impacts on the 2-kilometer-deep North American ice cap, as envisaged in the YDIH, the craters would have been excavated in ice that would have subsequently melted away, leaving little or no evidence on the ground beneath. Scientists have therefore developed other measures, more subtle than looking for craters, to detect cosmic impacts in the geological record. Nanodiamonds, for example, are microscopic diamonds that form under rare conditions of great shock, pressure, and heat, and are recognized as being among the characteristic fingerprints, proxies in scientific language, of powerful impacts by comets or asteroids. Other proxies include melt glass, resembling trinitite, tiny carbon spherules that form when molten droplets cool rapidly in air, magnetic microspherules, charcoal, soot, platinum, carbon molecules containing the rare isotope helium-3, and magnetic grains with iridium. Certain of the glassy and metallic proxies require temperatures in excess of 2,200 degrees centigrade to form. And there is nothing in nature, other than the heat and shock of a cosmic impact, that can instantly generate such temperatures. Alternative explanations might be offered for some of the other proxies, but when they occur together and in abundance, a cosmic impact again fits the evidence better than anything else. Moreover, to this day, scientists know of only two layers of sediment broadly distributed across several continents that exhibit coeval abundance peaks in a comprehensive assemblage of cosmic impact markers, including nanodiamonds, high-temperature quenched spherules, high-temperature melt glass, carbon spherules, iridium, and aciniform carbon. These layers are found at the Cretaceous-Paleogene boundary 65 million years ago, when it has long been agreed that a gigantic cosmic impact in the Gulf of Mexico caused the mass extinction of the dinosaurs, and at the Younger Dryas boundary 12,800 years ago. I have a question for Alan. Since the black mat was found draped directly on top of Eloise, like shrink wrap, you said, then presumably it must have begun to form very shortly after she was killed and butchered, with most of her remains left lying on the spot. What we see, Alan replies, is that at the bottom of that black mat layer, literally the first thing touching those bones are spherules, iridium, platinum, and small pieces of melt glass from the event. So it doesn't mean the animal was alive when the event happened, but she had to have been alive very, very shortly, at most a few weeks before it. I ask Alan to explain the black mat to me. I understand that the lowest part of it is full of impact proxies, laid down at the time the mat began to form, but clearly they're not the mat itself. The black mat formed on top of the layer of proxies, Alan replies. Down here, it has a lot of charcoal in it, but it also has algal remains, so it's not just fire. The Younger Dryas changed the climate and made the area much wetter. Algae began to grow along the edges of the lakes. He puts a hand on the black stripe along the arroyo wall. So the remains of about 1,000 years of dead algae, charcoal, and a lot of other stuff are all embedded in here. And at the bottom of it, where the impact happened, we find iridium, platinum, and a layer of melted spherules where the temperatures must have been so high that they would have melted a modern car into a pool of metal. So I ask, are you saying that there was an impact right here, at Murray Springs? Alan replies that it's not as simple as that. The bigger impacts were further north. Down here, it's more likely to have been an airburst, a fragment of the comet that literally blew up in the sky before hitting the ground. And the effect of that would have been what? If you'd been standing here, it would have seemed like the whole sky caught on fire, with the center of it brighter than the sun. And the thing is, it would have been totally silent. They would have heard nothing at first, because the speed of sound is a lot slower than the speed of light. My imagination has gone into overdrive. Could it have happened, I ask, while the Clovis hunters were actually butchering Eloise? Alan shakes his head. We know it didn't happen instantaneously, he reminds me, because they chopped her legs off and hauled one of them away and cooked it. But it could have happened later the same day, and like I say, it certainly happened within a couple of weeks. That's based on modern data from elephant kills in Africa. The scavengers come in quickly and disarticulate the skeleton, and that didn't happen with Eloise. This kill site sounds like unfinished business to me. That other haunch left up by Eloise's head, I reflect, and the rest of her intact, doesn't that suggest that the hunters were still in the vicinity and meant to come back to finish butchering her, but for some reason never did? Alan joins in with the spirit of the thought. Okay, he says. It's pure speculation, obviously, because we'll never know for sure the exact sequence of events here 12,800 years ago. But based on the evidence, it's not unreasonable to envisage the hunters sitting around, cooking mammoth haunch over their campfire, when all of a sudden, the sky explodes. And that's why they never go back for the rest of Eloise, I ask? Because they're all dead? Could be, Alan agrees. He jabs a finger into the base of the black mat and continues, but what we can be certain of was that this moment marked the end of their story, and the end of an epoch, really. There's not a single Clovis point found anywhere in North America that's above the black mat. They're all in it or below it. And there's not a single mammoth skeleton anywhere in North America that's above it. A huge part of the die-off could have been as a direct result of the impacts themselves, but impacts and airbursts south of the ice cap, particularly as far south as New Mexico, would also have set off wildfires. There's overwhelming evidence that gigantic wildfires raged at the onset of the Younger Dryas. In fact, more soot has been found at the Younger Dryas boundary than at the Cretaceous-Paleogene boundary. We did the calculations, and it looks like as much as 25% of the edible biomass and around 9% of the total biomass of the planet was on fire and destroyed within days or weeks of the Younger Dryas boundary. So in many areas, if the animals weren't killed outright, they wouldn't have been able to forage enough food afterwards to survive. The grass would have burned up, leaves on trees were gone, and you know, the other thing is that when comet fragments come in, they're traveling incredibly fast, and they literally punch a hole in the atmosphere. They actually push the air aside, and they bring in that super cold from space, and when they explode in the air, that cold plume continues to the ground, and you literally have things frozen in place if they were close enough to where the plume came down. It's possible they were fried and then frozen, all within a matter of seconds. Multiple injections of platinum. I ask Alan how long, in his opinion, the multiple impacts that kicked off the Younger Dryas were sustained for. Was it an overnight affair? Was it a matter of days? Was it weeks? He replies that there are levels of uncertainty, variables that will probably never be properly resolved. But that within those limits, what the evidence points to is not days or weeks, but a 21-year period of utter devastation, horror, and cataclysm unfolding between 12,836 years ago and 12,815 years ago, with a peak around 12,822 years ago. This ability to zoom in at very high resolution on a time window just 21 years wide and almost 13,000 years in the past comes to us courtesy of an amazing scientific resource consisting of ice cores from Greenland. Extracted with tubular drills that can reach depths of more than 3 kilometers, these cores preserve an unbroken 100,000-year record of any environmental and climatic events anywhere around the globe that affected the Greenland ice cap. What they show, and what Alan is referring to, is a mysterious spike in the metallic element platinum, a 21-year interval with elevated platinum, as he puts it now. So we know that was the length of the impact event, because there's very little way, once platinum falls on the ice sheet, that it can move around. It's pretty well locked in place. The backup to what Alan's saying is in a paper I'm already familiar with by Mikhail Pitayev of Harvard University's Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences and his colleagues Si-Chun Huang, Stein Jacobson, and Alan Zindler. Published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in August 2013, the self-explanatory title of the paper is Large Platinum Anomaly in the Greenland Ice Core Points to a Cataclysm at the Onset of Younger Dryas. Platinum is, of course, an element found on Earth, but analysis of the platinum in the ice cores by Pitayev and his colleagues reveals a composition quite unlike terrestrial platinum and leads the scientists to conclude that an extraterrestrial source, perhaps a metal impactor with an unusual composition, is the most likely explanation. They note also that during the 21-year interval between 12,836 and 12,815 years ago, as indicated by Alan, the platinum concentrations gradually rise by at least 100-fold over about 14 years and drop back during the subsequent 7 years. The observed gradual ingrowth of the platinum concentration in ice over about 14 years may suggest multiple injections of platinum-rich dust into the stratosphere. Alan's reading of what Pitayev's findings point to, shared widely by his colleagues, is that the impactor was in fact multiple impactors, all of them fragments of a comet that had wandered in from the outer solar system and taken up a potentially deadly Earth-crossing orbit. Though bound together by ice, comets have rocky cores that are often volatile, and it is in the nature of these cores to undergo fragmentation. Take comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, for example. It broke apart into 21 fragments, all of which smashed into the planet Jupiter over a period of 6 days in July 1994, with spectacular effect, creating huge, fiery explosions and dark scars, in some cases larger than the Earth, that persisted on the surface of the gas giant for many months. Something of the same sort is involved in Alan's vision, again widely shared by his colleagues, of what happened to the Earth at the Younger Dryas boundary. Drawing also on the work of William Napier, professor of astrobiology at the University of Cardiff, what the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis proposes, in brief, is a large parent comet in the range of 100 kilometers in diameter. Plunging in from the outer solar system, it enters an Earth-crossing orbit around 30,000 years ago and remains intact for the next 10,000 years. About 20,000 years ago, due to gravitational forces in the inner solar system, it undergoes a massive fragmentation event that transforms it from a single deadly and potentially world-killing object into multiple objects, varying in diameter from the extremely dangerous kilometer-plus range, down to a few tens of meters, down to chunks the size of cars, down to boulder-sized pieces, down to fist-sized rubble, and down beyond that to countless billions of smaller fragments and an immense penumbra of dust. As thousands of years pass, the whole turbulent mass of big and little pieces of the comet, orbiting at tens of thousands of kilometers per hour, begins to separate into multiple filaments, each filled with debris, eventually expanding to form a giant tubular meteor stream, some 30 million kilometers in diameter and extending more than 300 million kilometers across the entire orbit of the Earth, which it cuts in two places so that we must pass through the stream twice a year, traveling 2.5 million kilometers along its orbital path every day, the Earth takes 12 days to complete each passage through the stream. Because the meteor stream produces showers of shooting stars that look to observers on the ground as though they originate in the region of the sky occupied by the constellation Taurus, it's called the Taurid meteor stream. Our planet still passes through it twice a year, negotiating its dangerous inner filaments in late June and early July, when shooting stars are not visible because they are encountered in daylight, and again from late October into November, when a spectacular Halloween fireworks display is put on. On most of these biannual encounters with the Taurids, we just get the pretty fireworks, but occasionally we get more. On June 30th, 1908, for example, an object thought to have fallen out of the Taurid meteor stream and estimated to be somewhere between 60 and 190 meters in diameter, penetrated the Earth's atmosphere. It exploded in the air, fortunately, above an uninhabited region of Siberia, flattening 80 million trees across an area of 2,000 square kilometers. To put this in context, Greater London has an area of 1,582 square kilometers and a population of more than 7 million people. If transferred to London, Professor Napier calculates, the Tunguska airburst would have been heard throughout the UK, north to Denmark, and across Europe as far as Switzerland. Topsoil would have been stripped from the fields in the north of England. People in Oxford would have been thrown through the air and severely burned. An incandescent column of matter would have been thrown 20 kilometers in the air over London, and the city itself would have been destroyed about as far out as the present-day Ring Road. Impact energy estimates range from 3 to 12.5 megatons. The consequences, if an object of similar size were to explode over a major city today, would, in other words, be utterly catastrophic. But because the Tunguska event took place in a remote region before the era of modern mass communications, very few people are aware of how deadly even relatively small chunks of space rock can be. Professor Napier and his colleague Victor Klub, formerly Dean of the Astrophysics Department at Oxford University, go so far as to describe the unique complex of debris within the Taurid stream as the greatest collision hazard facing the Earth at the present time. Coordination of their findings with those of Alan West, Jim Kennett, and Richard Firestone has led both teams, the geophysicists and the astronomers, to conclude that it was very likely objects from the then much younger Taurid meteor stream that hit the Earth around 12,800 years ago and caused the onset of the Younger Dryas. These objects, orders of magnitude larger than the one that exploded over Tunguska, contained extraterrestrial platinum. And what the evidence from the Greenland ice cores seems to indicate is an epoch of 21 years in which the Earth was hit every year, with the bombardments increasing annually in intensity until the 14th year when they peaked, and then began to decline before ceasing in the 21st year. It's as though after dodging the bullet for thousands of years, I say to Alan as we walk back along the baking floor of the Arroyo, the Earth finally intersects a particularly lumpy and rocky filament of debris, and we get hit really hard, over and over again, year after year, until we've passed through it. Pataev himself says multiple injections of platinum, Alan reminds me. I think those were pretty much his exact words in the paper. So that's an independent assessment of the idea. There's something else, too, from new research we've been working on. In the ice core, at the exact same moment we see this big onset of platinum at the beginning of the 21 years, we also see a sudden rise in dust. Which tells you what? Which tells us that, along with everything else that was going on at the time, there were also very high winds blowing. There are certain proxies of that windiness that end up in the ice sheet. When it's windier, the winds will pick up continental dust. And number one, it's colder, so there's less plant cover. So when it gets windier and there are less plants to hold the sediment down, you get huge dust storms. We can see that build up in the Greenland ice sheet. we see magnesium and calcium, a huge increase in them. And those are indicative of pteriginous dust, continental dust. And we see an increase in sodium and chlorine, which are from sea salt. So the winds are so strong, they pick up more sea salt and deposit it in Greenland. The levels of these windiness proxies continue to climb for nearly 100 years. At the same time, we see one of the biggest peaks in the entire ice core in all the biomass burning proxies, and those occur within less than a 10-year window of the start of that 21-year interval. So you look at that, and the best explanation is the impact occurred, that it triggered immense biomass burning, and that it changed the climate radically, resulting in high winds and immense dust storms. So it was a combination of really horrible things? A cascade of bad things, Alan replies. It must have felt like the end of the world for those who lived through it. And particularly bad here in North America, the epicenter of the disaster. Much worse here than anywhere else, Alan confirms. A true calamity. But it wasn't only North America. We've traced evidence of further impacts from the same swarm in the exact same period in Europe, and as far east as Syria, and even into South America. The Struan field extends across more than 50 million square kilometers of the Earth's surface. New evidence. I have written extensively about the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis in Magicians of the Gods. There I present evidence that the impacts changed the world completely, and wipes from the record almost all traces, not only of the Clovis people, but also of an advanced civilization of the Ice Age. The fact that North America was the epicenter of the cataclysm, though acknowledged, has profound implications for our understanding of the human past that archaeologists have never thought through, in part because the scale of the cataclysm is only now beginning to be fully mapped out. After completing Magicians, therefore, I made sure I stayed up to date with the steady stream of new evidence released by Alan and his group in the scientific journals. There was a visible quickening in the pace of the research, and in 2017 and 2018, two major studies revealed how truly devastating the cataclysm at the onset of the Younger Dryas really was. If there was ever a time when a significant chapter in the story of human civilization could have been lost, this, surely, was it.